That's the great Etta James with Bob Dylan's You Gotta Serve Somebody. That's from her 2000 album, Etta James, Matriarch of the Blues. And let that be for the record, Matriarch of the Blues. Etta James, born James Etta Hawkins, did it all. Blues, jazz, gospel, R&B, rock and roll, pop, soul. Winner of 6 Grammys, 17 Blues Music Awards, inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1993, the Blues Hall of Fame in 2001, and the Grammy Hall of Fame in both 1999 and 2008. Rolling Stone listed her as among the 100 greatest singers of all time and among its list of 100 greatest artists. Etta James died in Riverside, California on January the 20th, 2012, a year after she was diagnosed with leukemia and 5 days before her 74th birthday. This is Lead Stories. I'm Eutrice Lead. It is Wednesday, September the 17th. My. And today, the peace president is a hostage of his own war. Oddly, it was his Nobel Peace Prize lecture on December the 10th, 2009, that first hinted that the peace candidate put into the White House just a year earlier by millions of Americans clinging to the Democrats' promise of hope and change they could believe in was in fact a war hawk like George W. Bush, his Republican predecessor. The ensuing years, and certainly last week's declaration of war against Islamic State terrorists holed up in pockets of Iraq and Syria, a pretext, as anyone could surmise, of the reinvasion of the former and the long-planned invasion of the latter, have removed all doubt. Obama's bomb first, talk later directive and his reckless disregard of the rule of law and democratic principles, both domestically and internationally, make Bush's state crimes, in some cases, look almost like mere slip-ups. So today we will dismantle Obama's warhead, and we will explain and explore why the president feels compelled to out-hawk the hawks, and how, ironically, it has made him a hostage of his cranked-up version of Bush's utterly disastrous war on terror. Now, since the declaration of war, we've had the same feel of insanity that has characterized this administration, where the left hand apparently doesn't know what the right hand is doing, and vice versa. The president declared war, but John Kerry said right after that, no, it really isn't war as such, per se. It's more like a military action. It is really not war. Then the next day, the president said, yes, it is war. Now, when the president says something and your Secretary of State says, well, that's not really what it is, and then the president has to come back the next day and say, yes, well, that's exactly what it is. It's a war. So I have declared war. And then we have this notion that there will be no boots on the ground. We will not have any more troops on Iraqi soil. And then we get word yesterday from his main war planner that, yes, it's possible that we'll have troops on the ground. So which is it? But, you know, this mirrors Obama's historic pattern in which there's a lot of wiggle room as to what he says, and what he means. And sometimes what he says is not exactly what he means. Sometimes what he means is not exactly what he says. And in any event, he's a smart guy, you see. And this is what has characterized his administration. A bunch of very smart people. He had a very smart Secretary of State, Hillary Clinton, who was very smart in her foreign policy. Very smart. And in fact, talked about smart diplomacy, because before she came along, diplomacy was pretty stupid. And this group as a whole, that was the group think. We are a bunch of really smart, educated Harvard types, and we know how to wiggle. We know how to maneuver. Well, of course, Hillary inherited that from her co-president, Bill Clinton, and they were very smart about the way they wiggled in and out of possible indictments, criminal indictments, over and over again. They very smartly evaded those things. So that gives the impression that they have the skills to bamboozle. They have the skills to make people really believe things that are really not true. And this president, when he was in the state senate in Illinois, the vast majority of his votes were just simply present. Not yay, not nay, just present. So that provided him a lot of wiggle room, a lot of elastic, so that he could not be accused one way or the other on any particular issue of taking sides with this on this issue this way or on that issue that way. He was just present. That is a very, very disturbing thing. Bill Blum, I was rereading his book, America's Deadliest Export, Democracy, the Truth About U.S. Foreign Policy and Everything Else. Well, of course, he's been on the program. And in a chapter on Obama, here's what he says. In his autobiography, Dreams of My Father, Barack Obama writes of taking a job at some point after graduating from Columbia University in 1983. He describes his employer as, quote, a consulting house to multinational corporations, unquote, in New York City, and his functions as a, quote, research assistant, unquote, and, quote, financial writer, unquote. Oddly, Obama doesn't mention the name of his employer. However, a New York Times story of 2007 identifies the company as Business International Corporation. Equally odd is that the Times did not remind its readers that the newspaper itself had disclosed in 1977 that Business International had provided cover for four CIA employees in various countries between 1955 and 1960. The British journal Lobster, which, despite its incongruous name, is a venerable international publication on intelligence matters, has reported that Business International was active in the 1980s promoting the candidacy of Washington-favored candidates in Australia and Fiji. In 1987, the CIA overthrew the Fiji government after but 1 month in office because of its policy of maintaining the island as a nuclear-free zone, meaning that American nuclear-powered or nuclear weapons-carrying ships could not make port calls. After the Fiji coup, the candidate supported by Business International, who was much more amenable to Washington's nuclear desires, was reinstated to power. Now, he goes on to say, in his book, Obama not only doesn't mention his employer's name, he fails to say exactly when he worked there or why he left the job. There may well be no significance to these omissions, but inasmuch as Business International has a long association with the world of intelligence, covert actions and attempts to penetrate the radical left, including Students for a Democratic Society, it's reasonable to wonder if the inscrutable Mr. Obama is concealing something about his own association with this world. Well, what Bill Blum is hinting at, what he's talking about here, is the very mixed signals one gets from Barack Obama. And certainly they got that when the country was in a state of euphoria about this bright, bushy-tailed young man, handsome, youthful, with great ideas, and if given the chance, could bring the change to America that millions and millions and millions of people were yearning for. And in support of that, they did the work themselves and overcame all these historic hurdles to working together. And they came behind this candidate and they said, "You're the guy." But what he was selling them was not exactly who he really was. And the same holds true for his administration so far. What Barack Obama stands for, nobody quite knows, because what he says is not exactly what he puts into action. I want to share with you perhaps the first hint of Barack Obama's views about war, because even in this scenario where the declaration of war exists, we have no idea what the man's thinking is. And we will get into that after we hear this little excerpt. And what we are about to hear is Barack Obama's Nobel lecture, when one is given the Nobel Peace Prize, as he was given in 2009. The laureate delivers an address, and it's quite a big deal in Oslo. And when you watch it, it is interesting. You see all these very stone-faced people listening to Barack Obama. The interesting thing is that he's talking at the Nobel Peace Prize lecture about war. And he's talking about principles that he upholds in war. And you will hear some statements that he makes that are completely at variance with the truth, but it is the first time that we have heard Barack Obama basically presenting his philosophy as head of state and commander in chief. Here's a pretty substantial clip. It's about 11 minutes, but it is quite revealing about the president's thinking of war.
I do not bring with me today a definitive solution to the problems of war. What I do know is that meeting these challenges will require the same vision, hard work, and persistence of those men and women who acted so boldly decades ago. And it will require us to think in new ways about the notions of just war and the imperatives of a just peace. We must begin by acknowledging a hard truth. We will not eradicate violent conflict in our lifetimes. There will be times when nations, acting individually or in concert, will find the use of force not only necessary, but morally justified. I make this statement mindful of what Martin Luther King Jr. said in this same ceremony years ago. Violence never brings permanent peace. It solves no social problem. It merely creates new and more complicated ones. As someone who stands here as a direct consequence of Dr. King's life work, I am living testimony to the moral force of nonviolence. I know there's nothing weak, nothing passive, nothing naive in the creed and lives of Gandhi and King, but as a head of state sworn to protect and defend my nation, I cannot be guided by their examples alone. I face the world as it is and cannot stand idle in the face of threats to the American people. For make no mistake, evil does exist in the world. A nonviolent movement could not have halted Hitler's armies. Negotiations cannot convince Al-Qaeda's leaders to lay down their arms. To say that force may sometimes be necessary is not a call to cynicism, it is a recognition of history, the imperfections of man, and the limits of reason. I raise this point, I begin with this point, because in many countries there is a deep ambivalence about military action today, no matter what the cause. And at times this is joined by a reflexive suspicion of America, the world's sole military superpower. Yet the world must remember that it was not simply international institutions, not just treaties and declarations, that brought stability to a post-World War II world. Whatever mistakes we have made, the plain fact is this: the United States of America has helped underwrite global security for more than six decades with the blood of our citizens and the strength of our arms. The service and sacrifice of our men and women in uniform has promoted peace and prosperity from Germany to Korea and enabled democracy to take hold in places like the Balkans. We have borne this burden not because we seek to impose our will. We have done so out of enlightened self-interest, because we seek a better future for our children and grandchildren, and we believe that their lives will be better if others' children and grandchildren can live in freedom and prosperity. So yes, the instruments of war do have a role to play in preserving the peace. And yet this truth must coexist with another: that no matter how justified, war promises human tragedy. The soldier's courage and sacrifice is full of glory, expressing devotion to country, to cause, to comrades in arms. But war itself is never glorious, and we must never trumpet it as such. So part of our challenge is reconciling these two seemingly irreconcilable truths: that war is sometimes necessary, and war at some level is an expression of human folly. Concretely, we must direct our effort to the task that President Kennedy called for long ago. Let us focus, he said, on a more practical, more attainable peace, based not on a sudden revolution in human nature, but on a gradual evolution in human institutions. A gradual evolution of human institutions. What might this evolution look like? What might these practical steps be? To begin with, I believe that all nations, strong and weak alike, must adhere to standards that govern the use of force. I, like any head of state, reserve the right to act unilaterally if necessary to defend my nation. Nevertheless, I am convinced that adhering to standards, international standards, strengthens those who do, and isolates and weakens those who don't. The world rallied around America after the 9/11 attacks and continues to support our efforts in Afghanistan because of the horror of those senseless attacks and the recognized principle of self-defense. Likewise, the world recognized the need to confront Saddam Hussein when he invaded Kuwait, a consensus that sent a clear message to all about the cost of aggression. Furthermore, America, in fact, no nation, can insist that others follow the rules of the road if we refuse to follow them ourselves. For when we don't, our actions appear arbitrary and undercut the legitimacy of future interventions, no matter how justified. And this becomes particularly important when the purpose of military action extends beyond self-defense or defense of one nation against an aggressor. More and more, we all confront difficult questions about how to prevent the slaughter of civilians by their own government, or to stop a civil war whose violence and suffering can engulf an entire region. I believe that force can be justified on humanitarian grounds, as it was in the Balkans or in other places that have been scarred by war. Inaction tears at our conscience and can lead to more costly intervention later. And that's why all responsible nations must embrace the role that militaries with a clear mandate can play to keep the peace. America's commitment to global security will never waver, but in a world in which threats are more diffuse and missions more complex, America cannot act alone. America alone cannot secure the peace. This is true in Afghanistan. This is true in failed states like Somalia, where terrorism and piracy is joined by famine and human suffering. And sadly, it will continue to be true in unstable regions for years to come. The leaders and soldiers of NATO countries and other friends and allies demonstrate this truth through the capacity and courage they've shown in Afghanistan. But in many countries, there is a disconnect between the efforts of those who serve and the ambivalence of the broader public. I understand why war is not popular, but I also know this: the belief that peace is desirable is rarely enough to achieve it. Peace requires responsibility. Peace entails sacrifice. That's why NATO continues to be indispensable. That's why we must strengthen UN and regional peacekeeping, and not leave the task to a few countries. That's why we honor those who return home from peacekeeping and training abroad, to Oslo and Rome, to Ottawa and Sydney, to Dhaka and Kigali. We honor them not as makers of war, but as wagers of peace. Let me make one final point about the use of force. Even as we make difficult decisions about going to war, we must also think clearly about how we fight it. The Nobel Committee recognized this truth in awarding its first prize for peace to Henri Dunant, the founder of the Red Cross and a driving force behind the Geneva Conventions. Where force is necessary, we have a moral and strategic interest in binding ourselves to certain rules of conduct. And even as we confront a vicious adversary that abides by no rules, I believe the United States of America must remain a standard bearer in the conduct of war. That is what makes us different from those whom we fight. That is a source of our strength. That is why I prohibited torture. That is why I ordered the prison at Guantanamo Bay closed. And that is why I have reaffirmed America's commitment to abide by the Geneva Conventions. We lose ourselves when we compromise the very ideals that we fight to defend.
Yes, that's your president, Barack Hussein Obama, delivering his Nobel lecture in 2009 upon receiving that year's Nobel Peace Prize. And you would notice quite a few things said there that should have ruffled your feathers by now, including and most the most recent statement that we heard in this clip about America being the standard bearer for the conduct of war and abiding by the rules of war. and the law, international law, and how he closed Guantanamo Bay and rejected torture and so forth. The same president who said, oh yeah, we tortured some folks, is announcing, of course, his opposition to torture. Well, you must keep in mind this particular speech and its significance in that here, for whatever reason, that the Nobel Committee decided that the president at that time, up to his eyeballs in the warfare that he inherited from George Bush, and doing a job to do better at war than George Bush. Why they chose him, it's still up in the air, although there are committees all over the world demanding that the Nobel Committee rescind or ask for the Nobel Prize back, ask that he return it. But that horse has already left the barn. But what is significant here is the absolute disconnect at this moment in time. The president chooses to lecture on war as actually peace, peace as war. It's you wonder, is there somebody who should have said to him, you know, this is not a good idea to talk about war at the Nobel Peace Prize lecture and why you support war? But what we got was the clearest indication we had so far of the president's own thinking. And what emerges is that the president, basically the speech being authored for him, of course he does a bit of name dropping, associating himself with Martin Luther King, who was completely anti-war, and with John F. Kennedy in his mind, and he meant to convey that he is the political standard bearer for, if you will, for the way Barack Obama interprets the role of the United States, especially in making war. So he drops the heavyweight names, and that is supposed to take the edge off of the current situation when he's standing there before the world, basically extolling the virtues of war, the excellence of the United States in fighting wars, and why the United States is better at it and should be trusted more than any other country in fighting wars, because the United States is the standard bearer. The United States knows how to obey international laws, and the United States fights wars. And this is the articulation of his so-called just war theory. Now, we bring this up to date. Why is the president so ambivalent? Why are we getting all these mixed signals? Well, because A, the president is all about mixed signals. When he was running, nobody knew quite who he was. We knew what the image was, the manufactured image was. We knew what they wanted us to see, what they wanted us to know. We knew the package that was presented, and it was pristine. What we didn't know was who was pulling the strings, who was actually handling the president, who actually owned him. And as Etta James was just singing to us, whose interest is he serving? Who is he serving? I want to just deal with that question today, because we will get into the actual Obama's actual history and involvement in war and warfare. But this question of whose interest is he serving? Who's pulling the strings? And we will want to get a sense from you when you call in at 888-874-4888. What, having heard what he just said, what do you make of what he says now? and what he's doing now about war. We'll take this break, come back to your questions and calls right after this.
You may be a creature with a spiritual pride. You may be a councilman taking bribes on the side. Working in a barber shop, may know how to cut hair. Maybe somebody's mistress, or maybe somebody's serve somebody. Oh, yeah, serve somebody. It might be the devil or the Lord, but you got to serve somebody, yeah. Might like to wear cotton, might like to wear silk. Might like to drink whiskey, might like to drink milk, might like to eat caviar, might like to eat bread, maybe sleeping on the floor, even on a king-size bed, but you gotta serve somebody.
You're listening to PRN.FM, and you're listening to Lead Stories on PRN.FM. We're talking about the president and his thinking, his philosophy about war. And we just got a glimpse of that thinking from a speech that he made in 2009 as he accepted the Nobel Peace Prize that year. And why is this important? Because we don't know what this president is actually thinking. And we know what we do know is that the president is not the person making the decision. There is a whole complex that is making decisions for this president. And it started from the word go. He is basically presented to the country to articulate the desires and the aims and objectives of people who own him and whose interests he serves. So we have a president telling the nation that this is the declaration of war against the Islamic State is, of course, a preemptive action, but we see that it is not exactly that, is it? That he is targeting Iraq, he's targeting Syria because they happen to be there, but it's not exactly that, is it? It is because the United States has been basically trying to get back into Iraq and trying to take over Syria. I mean, that's what the deal is here. But it is not said that way. It is said that the United States, in the interest of global peace and justice, we're pursuing the Islamic State terrorist jihadists who hold up in portions of Iraq and Syria, and we are going after them in the name of justice. But that's not the truth, is it? That's not the real reason, is it? We're told that there will be no boots on the ground, knowing full well that there already are boots on the ground. They're calling them advisors, and they're calling them military experts. They're there already. And this will not be a ground war. Well, of course. But again, the game is being played with our heads. It's not a ground war because, you know, the airstrikes have already begun. Because this is a smart guy. This is a smart president. You see? And so what he says is not exactly what it is. It's all about what it looks like, what it sounds like, what he can sell to the people. Who is he serving, or whom is he serving? Joel from New York, you're on the air.
Good afternoon, Eutrice.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thank you. You know, that speech, I remember that speech well, as we all do, but that speech was 5 years ago, so we've had 5 years of his true aims to be able to make judgments about. And I think that when and if, let's hope the if is real, historians write about this administration, they're going to associate him with the terror war, a global terror war, and the moral insanity that that war continues to spawn. You know, now we see this hysteria of radical jihadism sweeping across the shores of the Mediterranean and Syria and Libya, constituting, according to Western European leaders, a threat to Europe. And, you know, one of the things that's been going on recently, and that reflects on what Obama had to say, is that U.S. and European politicians don't want to explain why, 13 years after 9/11, when the war on terror was supposedly launched, thousands of jihadists have been able to carve out enclaves so close to Europe. And they won't explain it, because any honest explanation would expose the emptiness at the core of all of their pro-offered reasons for the terror war. That's why I would say that Obama's policy is not only frozen, it's been bankrupt. They can't explain it, and Obama can't explain it, because the terror war system, including the increased militarization and repression in our own country, has now become the organizing principle of Western society. Or rather, it is maybe the latest incarnation of what has been the guiding principle of Western society since the Second World War, organizing society and the economy around war, either active war or the ever-present threat of war, for government and for big business, the immense power, profit, and control they inevitably accrue from conducting wars, in this case, a terror war, on a global basis, is far enticing to give up at any time. The full mobilization of society's resources for war simply carried on throughout these years and has been carried on in the Obama administration. Indeed, it's being expanded and amplified. And it has a life-transforming impact on many of its survivors, which, of course, he didn't talk about in his address. It seems to me that you know, for a brief period in my lifetime and in your lifetime, there was an attempt to balance the two opposing organizing principles of society, war and human betterment. And we saw this in Johnson's Great Society and War and Poverty programs. But Johnson was also a product and propagator of a war system. Like Obama, pardon me?
I said absolutely.
Yeah. Like Obama, he was a hawk. He was eager to project dominance, eager to subvert and overthrow recalcitrant states and employ violence on a massive, indiscriminate, and lucrative scale. And the Vietnam War destroyed his presidency, crippled, you know, the momentum of the social programs, and accelerated the triumph of the war principle. This is what we have now. I think this is what we're facing. And it seems to me that the terror war of Obama and the concomitant degradation of society and individual lives shows in stark relief that the system is producing exactly what it aims to produce.
Speaking of degradation,
and despair.
I want to ask you your views on where the so-called peace movement is and the so-called progressive movement is with
respect
to this president.
Well, that's a really good question. What a good question. You know, it's almost as if the peace movement has become inscrutable in its caution. And I think, as I've said before on your program, I think that a viable peace movement requires more than simply mobilization. Just like the civil rights movement required more than mobilization, it required organization. It's not enough to get out there on a fine sunny day and, you know, have a mobilization against this latest outrage. What we have to do is start organizing on a serious basis away from the two corporate parties who are going to support this because, after all, the war economy not only brings death and despair, it also brings record-breaking profits. So we must that's the only way that we can create a viable peace. If we just decide that we're going to get together, march, and then go home, we're going to do what is right now benumbing the civil rights movement, you know, all these marches in relation to police violence, and not enough organizing on the ground so that we can make real transformative change.
Well, you see, this is going to be the next leg of our discussion here, but this is an opportune moment to raise it, and that is, this is such a great time to get that kind of work done because, A, the Democratic Party has shown itself to be absolutely no different at all, except perhaps even more enthusiastic where this matter of war is concerned than the Republican Party. But the Democratic Party should by now have proven itself among a vast swath of the people who supported Obama to be utterly useless, and in fact, a factor in the lack of progress that the country has made on the domestic front, and basically the chaos it has created on the international front. This is a time for independent parties to come forward, but we're not hearing very much about that. Number two, we have an opportune moment here to confront this question about these so-called liberal types like Obama, who are created for public consumption, but they are carrying out some of the most lethal programs. And Obama is, of course, most visible, but we have Obamas at the state level throughout the United States, really eviscerating programs that should be benefiting the vast majority of people and so forth. They're carrying out an ultra-conservative agenda and getting away with it because they are, quote, Democrats, unquote. This is a time to really mobilize alternatives.
And we need to start thinking in terms of an alternative grassroots politics, and we have to start doing it right away because the situation out there is really dire. We have 100 million Americans who are looking for full-time work. The possibility of all of the equity markets crashing and, you know, all of these retirees, who depending on their 401ks being wiped out, this is a very difficult time, and we can't simply even ruminate on it. We really have to act. And acts. And that's why, by the way, I brought up the whole question in reference to the comment you just made about Lyndon Johnson. Because Johnson, unlike Obama, who was a faux liberal, you know, he's a neoliberal, neoconservative, Johnson was a real liberal, a real New Deal liberal, but he also fell prey to the desires and the needs of the war economy. And it destroyed his presidency. So, you know, the Democrats have always been like this. In fact, even during the Carter administration, I'm old enough to remember the two chairs of the Council of Economic Advisors, William Oakham and Charles Schultz, both of whom began to attack the possibility of socially progressive programs because they thought it would interfere in the efficiency of business, in other words, profits, which was the first sign of austerity. And I think there was a kind of austerity light under Carter. So I think this thing predates. You know, a lot of the liberals like to say, it was all Reagan's fault. Reagan introduced all these neoliberal Well, the Democrats paved the way for him. And then after Reagan was gone, we saw, you know, what Clinton did and what Obama is doing. So it is a time of crisis, and we have to act like adults and do what has to be done, if for only to preserve our own dignity.
And the
final thing I want to say is that there's nothing about the Obama presidency that really suggests to me that there is any interest in what we used to call the common good.
I would agree with that wholeheartedly. Thank you so much for your call today, Joel. 888-874-4888. We have to deal with the fact that, you know, the thinking of a person in large measure informs what the person would do. And that little clip that we just heard at that occasion tells us a heck of a lot about a president. A, not even understanding the significance of the moment, and basically observing tact, even just on the basis of tact. You are receiving Nobel Peace Prize, and your theme is that you are extolling the virtues of war. And not only that, you're selling the U.S. brand of war as the best brand available. We know war like nobody else. We do war better than anybody. My goodness. From Los Angeles, DX, you're on the air.
Hello, Eutrice. How are you today?
Fine, thank you. I hope you are, too.
Yeah, I'm doing fine. You brought back some memories with that speech, and there was only one name that came to mind while I was listening to that just as when I first heard it, and that name is George Orwell. Because this guy, not only if you say one thing and do another, but it's like you said, war is peace, peace is war, black is white, up is down. This has so many different, now that you look back on it, it's really, really, it's ominous. It just shows that what he's saying is, I'm going to sit here and accept this peace prize, but there is no way I'm going to fulfill the agenda of a peace president. Basically, is what he's saying. Mm-hmm. I mean, because he's equivocating. He's going, okay, well, nobody really wants war, but then there are times when you have to blow people up and kill people. You know. I mean, that's exactly what he's saying, and it's amazing that people didn't just start booing and walking out of there. Because what are you talking about? I mean, this is just, oh wow. I mean, I'm glad you played it.
The thing was that he seemed to have misinterpreted the look, the stone-faced look on the members of the audience. They looking at him in that fashion that says, does he really understand what this is about and what is this supposed
right.
to be?
And
and he's interpreting it that he's commanding their attention because he's mm-hmm. so effective.
And I'm going to have to go back and look at the video, but I mean, I'm sitting here listening to it and I'm thinking, what kind of media do we have in this country that they cover this and it's just okay? It's okay. He said that, we don't want war, but sometimes we have to do what we have to do to quote unquote protect the United States. And everybody knows that no country or entity in this world can challenge the United States. I mean, come on, that's just ridiculous.
And be wagers of peace and all these, this kind of kerfuffling that goes on. But this is so typical. And this is what is important to understand about Barack Obama. It's like nailing jello to a wall. There is no core there that he would actually say, this is what I stand for. Because he doesn't stand for anything. He is the mere, how should I say, the transmitter of other people's views, other people's plans. That's what he is, and that's what he has been since coming into office. And
absolutely.
Even before that,
that's
as a candidate,
probably the
he
reason
is
he
what
was
they
selected.
Want them to be.
That's probably the reason he was selected.
Of course,
of
course. Quite amenable, quite, adaptable. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the idea is that he is so smart that he can sell ice to Eskimos. He's so smooth. He's so convincing. But when you look behind what it is he's saying, you see that there is, you can't really identify core beliefs. I mean, solid, rock solid core beliefs that are unique to him at any level, in any possible situation. You cannot count on getting a solid, truthful, straight up answer from Barack Obama. And his administration
charm,
is exactly the same
thing. Let me
tell
you something, one last thing, Eutrice. And that charm goes so deep that if you try to tell somebody who is a supporter of his, well, I was talking to my mother yesterday, and as we know, this group in her age, she's 72, so this group in her age, I mean, I understand being proud that we have a black president, but you have to look at reality. So I'm telling her basically this guy is the same as, what I said at first was this guy is pretty much the same as Bush. And then what they do after that is they start making up excuses for him. well, you know, the president really doesn't have all that much power, and he's just doing what he has to do, and blah, blah, blah. Well, when he was running for office, I thought you voted for him because he was going to make all these big changes, and he would have some power. But now that he's doing everything they want him to do, well, you know, he can't. There's only so much he can do. But, Mom, you know, he's actually, then I rephrase it, I said he's actually even worse than George Bush because he's carrying out an agenda and saying exactly the opposite in public, and people believe it, you know? So that charm that he has, I mean, I know that it affects everyone, but black people especially, and black women especially, and it's so annoying, it's so frustrating that they can't even see what this guy is really all about and what he's doing.
So what do you think is in the very near future, let's say in the next week, because we have seen so many flip-flops since Wednesday, last Wednesday, when he made this declaration of war. Are we at war? Yes. No. Yes. No. Yes. Is this a war? Well, actually, it's not. It's a military act. Oh, yes. Well, it's a war. So how long would it last? Well, we are operating under the authorization of use of force. And it is amazing that this is what is passing for leadership in our country at a time not only that is so critical, but with the severity of the issue and the severity of the possible consequences and impact of these decisions. And we have a leader who has made a career out of not being specific about anything.
Well, I think part of that, Utrice, is what we talked about the other day, which is his Obama brand. He's very concerned about that, I think. Not the American people, not anything else, but he's concerned about his Obama brand. And I'm sure the people he has around him are concerned about it, too. He wants his Obama brand to stand for certain things. And all this nonsense they have him doing, a lot of it runs counter to that. So basically, he's having to face the fact that you just lied to the American people, straight out lied again. And, you know, maybe he's afraid he's going to get found out by the biggest majority of his supporters. I don't know, but this guy, the discombobulation in his whole program when it comes to not only foreign affairs but domestic things, too, it's amazing. And, you know, I think part of that is it. Him and his people closest to him are afraid of the damage to the Obama brand. I think that's all they're really worried about.
But nobody's doing greater damage to him than the president himself.
Carry out, so he's kind of torn between the two.
Well, thank you very much for your call today. Thanks so much, TX.
Okay, thank you. Have a great day.
You too. Well, I want you to just cogitate on this a bit, because this theme is going to occur several times in our discussions and our ensuing discussions over the next couple of weeks, because it is a constant factor in policy making that this administration essentially emulates this characteristic or mindset, that it is about a sale, making a sale. It's doing whatever it is you have to do to convince people that you're telling them the truth and you're being straight up with them. But this speech in 2009, the significance of it is that it is perhaps the most comprehensive evidence that we have to date of the president's thinking, at least his professed thinking about war, what informs his thinking about war, and of his role as head of state and as commander-in-chief. I hope this program was at least a bit illuminating to you today. Let me know what you think. Send me a note at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Utrice Lead. Keep it right here. Coming up next is Economic Update with Richard Wolff. And again, until tomorrow, a pleasure and a great privilege to be in your company.